Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. Last week we looked at family history. This week we take up the related subject of marriage and how it has evolved over the years. Also in today's program, we have a commentary on Hitler's gamble in September 1941. But before we get to those subjects, let's take a look at an important event that occurred this week in history. On September 26, 1960, the first of four televised presidential debates between candidates Richard Nixon and John Kennedy took place in Chicago. The debate was viewed by an estimated 85 to 120 million Americans, marking a turning point in the influence of television on the voting public. The 1960 election was the closest presidential contest since the election of 1884. Kennedy defeated Nixon by a margin of only 118,000 votes out of some 70 million votes cast, and many considered Kennedy's victory in no small part due to his more favorable TV image. Both candidates displayed a firm grasp of the issues, but Kennedy's poise in front of the camera, his youthful good looks and charisma and easy wit, convinced TV viewers that Kennedy won the debates. Many observers decried the impact of television on the election, arguing that it detracted from any serious attention to the issues, but a new age of political campaigning had begun. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, historians have long known that Abraham Lincoln, revered for his calm and focused leadership during the crisis of the Civil War, was prone to sudden mood swings and angry outbursts, particularly before he became president. Researchers now say that Lincoln's flashes of temper may have been symptoms of mercury poisoning brought about by a common 19th century treatment for depression. During his days as an Illinois lawyer, Lincoln took 2 to 3 mercury pills each day, which would have exposed him to mercury levels nearly 9,000 times what current federal guidelines allow. Researchers say it may be impossible to prove Lincoln had mercury poisoning without a hair sample from those early days. But they point out Lincoln's better-known personality appeared after he entered the White House and after he stopped taking the pills. This is Talking History.
Go into the chapel and it's gonna get married. Go into the chapel and it's gonna get married.
Marriage is one of the most hallowed traditions, rituals, and institutions in American society and culture, but it is also an institution closely linked to the state. Here to look at that aspect of marriage is Talking History's Fred Nielsen.
Most Americans view marriage as a private institution, one that formalizes an intimate relationship between two people. Yet it's also a public institution. And because marriage is seen as a pillar of the state, government has long influenced and shaped it. Here to discuss this connection is Nancy Cott, professor of history and American studies at Yale University. Her most recent book is Public Vows, A History of Marriage and the Nation. Professor Cott, welcome.
Thank you.
The United States is a country founded on self-evident truths, what Jefferson and others considered common sense. You make the point that common sense is what the mind filled with presuppositions concludes. What has Americans' common sense been about marriage?
Well, I think that, looking at it that way, is especially important for early America when there were very few people to enforce any marriage rules, and the reason that marriage was orderly at all was because most of the white settlers shared a common sense notion of what constituted marriage, and their common sense descended both from the fact that they were Christians, that they were Protestants, and also that they'd come from the English system of common law, and both of these systems prescribed marriage as a joining of a man and woman in a lifelong bond that implied sexual fidelity. That wasn't the notion of marriage that most of the people in the rest of the globe had at that time. And when the United States was founded, the Native Americans living on the North American continent had a whole number of different marriage systems that involved polygamy in some cases, that involved self-divorce and remarriage, that involved matrilineality, that is the line of descent going through the mother rather than through the father, which was the norm and the common sense for English settlers. And so the shared Christian and Anglo-American legal common sense of marriage among early Americans was very important in making them feel they were a people, I think that that overarching notion persisted through much of the 1800s and into the 20th century. And one of the reasons people feel so unsettled about marriage today is that their common sense of what it is has been so shaken up by the demographic changes of the last 35 years, mm-hmm. as well as by changes in sexual morality.
So at the beginning, we have Americans marrying themselves often without formal rituals. We have them even divorcing themselves. And yet at some point, the state does get involved. How and why does the state get involved in dictating what proper marriage is?
Well, in fact, the state is involved from the very beginning. The colonial legal systems, one of the first things all the early colonies did was to set up marriage rules saying who could marry whom, who couldn't marry whom, prohibiting, for instance, incestuous marriages, prohibiting in some of the southern colonies, this happened in the 1600s, prohibiting a white person from marrying a person of color. Also prohibiting, in some cases, marriage within certain degrees of affinity, that is, certain relations that we wouldn't think of as incestuous, like a cousin marriage, but some people at that time did. So these rules were set up, and also rules about who could officiate, what kinds of judges or justices of the peace or legislators or ministers could perform legal marriages. So the laws, the regulations were there from the very beginning. However, the way settlement took place, people often moved to areas where they were fairly remote from settlement. There weren't enough magistrates or ministers around, particularly ministers and particularly in the southern colonies. So in order to get married or to form a union, people would just marry themselves, going along on what they saw as their common sense of the bargain, which included sexual fidelity, as I said, and also included, very importantly, and I think this has descended to us, an economic bargain. That is, that the husband would support the wife, which meant he would provide for her, and her part of the bargain was that her service, her labor, her ability to use all of her talents were his. They became his, and so did her property. If she came from a rich family and her father had given her money or land, or in the southern states, well, actually all over the colonies initially, given her slaves, these things all belonged to her husband once she married him, and he had, in response, the obligation to support her and, of course, their children. So this was well understood as what constituted marriage, whether or not a formal ceremony took place. And neighbors and kin tended to be a local community enforcing the terms of marriage, chastising people who didn't provide, wives who didn't obey, spouses who deserted the other, spouses who were unfaithful. There was what I think we could call local control, local surveillance of marriages that operated fairly effectively to keep this common sense of the bargain in place.
You write in Public Vows that turning men and women into husbands and wives, marriage has designated the ways both sexes act in the world and the reciprocal relationship between them. You've touched on a little bit of that already, but I wonder if you could elaborate on some of the other ways in which a woman's status particularly changes when she becomes a wife.
Well, I'd be happy to talk about that. I think one of the things I most wanted to convey in writing this book about marriage from a public perspective, which is not the way it's usually viewed, was to show how far the state, at the state level, and the nation, in the form of laws and public policy, had affected through all of the United States history the way men think of themselves as men and citizens and the way women think of themselves as women and as citizens. That marriage is such an important institutional vehicle for conveying these self-understandings to people as well as literally regulating them and forming what they can do and can't do and setting up their status. I think it's very, very difficult for people, whether they individually marry or not, to escape the impact of marriage as an institution. And as I was saying before, I think the economic bargain between the husband and the wife, which was established long, long ago in English common law, the notion that the husband is the primary economic actor, and that while the wife has a definite economic part and it's part of her agreeing to marry, it's a secondary part. I think that structuring of men and women in their lives in general has been crucially important, and I think it's easy to still see its impact today in the labor market, in the way men and women think about their careers and their occupations. And with regard to citizenship, this is something that often doesn't cross people's mind, but in the very making of American democracy and the way our Constitution is set up, a major reason that men were the voters and that men over 21 were the voters was their status as husbands, as providers for their families, not only for their wives, but for their children and for their servants or any other dependents in the household. I mean, I'm not saying that every man fulfilled this to a T, but that structurally this was a man's responsibility. It's a major thing that made him have to be represented, have to represent himself in the community, and was an underpinning of his role as a citizen, his empowerment as a citizen. And while we don't literally have this in our law or in our voting franchise anymore, I think there is a long legacy of this in our political system, and the notion we certainly, even now in the 21st century, far more men are in the political world as active agents than women, I mean, at the level of public office, certainly. Although this is changing, just as the economic bargain that is constituted in marriage has changed, and so on. I mean, with respect to women, I think that the role of wife being a dependent, not representing herself in the political system, being represented by her husband, had everything to do with the long, long time it took for women to get the vote, even though there were many countervailing trends, at least in the ideals of American democracy, about the right of every individual to have a voice, to consent to being governed, and so on. But there was this very, very strong tradition that I believe marriage was the vehicle for and the embodiment of, more than sex per se or gender per se. There were, interestingly, a couple of places in the early United States where women with property could vote, say widows. New Jersey was an example where between the 1770s and the very early 1800s, women with property could vote. And that property that they had stood in for what a man as a head of household had, that is, responsibility for some material assets and provision of that sort, which gave him independence in the economy and the society.
Laws about marriage, or perhaps I should say assumptions about marriage, show up in places that we wouldn't necessarily expect to see them. You write, for example, about the history of immigration, about the impact of the New Deal legislation of the 1930s, not just in the ways we're used to hearing about these things, but particularly with attention to how they affected men and women or husbands and wives in different ways. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. I think it's really striking how far marriage issues appear in lots of elements in national public policy where you might not expect it, especially since marriage is regulated at the state level and not at the national level at all. I mean, one place where I think it was hugely important was in the struggle between the North and the South over slavery, in that slaves were not allowed to marry legally. Of course, they formed unions, had families, but those unions and those families could always be broken by the master's will. There was no legal protection for a marriage among slaves because slaves did not have the power, not being free, did not have the power to consent to marriage and didn't have the power to maintain their marriages. The master had the supreme power. So that deformation of common sense in the view of those who were in the North and against slavery was a very important reason why slavery should be destroyed on the one hand, on the Northern view of the matter. On the other hand, on the South, there was a very interesting argument about marriage and slavery that not many people today are aware of. That is, Southerners who apologized for slavery and saw it as a beneficial system talked about the treatment of slaves, in terms of how slaves were dependents who were benefited by being taken care of by a master, and they made a parallel or an analogy between how slaves were in that relationship to how wives were vis-a-vis their husbands, because they assumed that everybody liked the marriage relation as it was, the husband, the superior partner. They said, look, slavery is just as good. The master is the superior partner in this case, and the slave benefits from being provided for just the way wives benefit from being taken care of by their husbands. So both of these things were rooted, according to Southern apologists, in nature. Both race on the one hand and sex on the other dictated that these groups were to be the dependent and were to be the subordinated. This, therefore, it was really an argument over marriage forms was part of what was going on between the North and the South and arguing about why slavery was or wasn't a system that should be able to persist in the United States. And then subsequently, after the Civil War was fought and the North, the Union, was victorious, the slaves were freed, then the federal government made a tremendous effort to make sure that emancipated slaves would marry. They didn't want any divergence within the nation. If we were to have a national standard, a national way of life that could be upheld as the American way of life, then all emancipated slaves had to marry legally, and no kind of warping of that was to be prevented, just like no Mormon polygamy was to be prevented. This was another issue of the day. Let me just talk a bit about immigration, where I think this is really quite interesting. When many, many immigrants from faraway places started coming to the United States, especially after 1890, their marriage practices became a criterion which immigration bureau chiefs would judge to decide on entrance likelihood of becoming good American citizens. And marriage systems that were non-conforming, certainly polygamous marriage systems, non-Christian systems such as those practiced by the Chinese and the Japanese, these were very, very suspect. Japanese immigrants who had been married by a system called proxy marriage or photo marriage, in which the two partners were not literally in the same place when the marriage took place, they were forced to remarry right at the Immigration Bureau location on American soil to consider themselves validly married. So that these assumptions and, in fact, regulations came into play in places we wouldn't necessarily expect them to.
Mm-hmm. We began talking about common sense, and I wonder as we close, we have a minute or so left, has our American common sense changed at all in the 21st century?
Well, I come up with an ambiguous view on this, because on the one sense, yes, certainly the extent of cohabitation outside of marriage that is approved today, and provisions like no-fault divorce, and the proportion of children being born outside of wedlock without huge social sanction or legal sanction, these things suggest that, yes, our common sense has vastly, vastly changed. But then again, there are other signs in the other direction. I mean, one is the Defense of Marriage Act, passed at the federal level in 96, and then many, many states have reaffirmed that marriage is only between a man and a woman, suggesting that at least our common sense stops, the majority common sense, that is, stops at the door of same-sex marriage. And also, I think welfare reform, particularly in the last 5 years, the rhetoric of welfare reform and even the literal language of the major Reform Act passed in 1996 champions marriage on a conventional model as the way to assume full American belonging and appropriate citizenship. And those things are very much at the highest official level. They presumably embody the common sense of the populace as expressed through their representatives in Congress. And so I'd be hard put to say that our common sense about marriage has overall been as unsettled as one might think, given the landscape of diverse choices of individual lives these days.
Well, thank you, Professor Cott, so much for talking with us.
You're welcome. It was a pleasure.
We've been listening to Nancy Cott, author of Public Vows, A History of Marriage and the Nation.
Johnny! Johnny!
In September 1941, German leader Adolf Hitler invaded the Soviet Union. It was a calculated risk on Hitler's part, calculated to extend his grip on Europe. On this, its 60th anniversary, historian Michael Richards looks back at that historic event.
60 years ago, in September 1941, the fate of the world hung in the balance. Adolf Hitler, gambling recklessly with the German nation, had launched the Nazi invasion of the Soviet Union in quest of world domination. It seemed certain he would win his gamble. The German invasion of the Soviet Union was probably the most important event of World War II. There is no doubt it shaped the remainder of the 20th century. By destroying the old world, Hitler created a new one that has ever since demanded constant attention from the United States. The Nazi Führer intended his campaign against the Soviet Union to destroy what he called Jewish Bolshevism. This, he believed, would end any hope Great Britain had of winning the war and discourage the United States from entering on the side of Britain. The campaign also had a world historical goal. It would furnish a final solution to what the Nazis called the Jewish question, the conviction that the Jews were parasites and could only destroy, not build, civilization. By the end of 1941, the Nazis were already putting into place the Holocaust, which eventually killed 6 million Jews. Nazi Germany grossly underestimated the capacity of the Soviet Union to resist. At incredible cost, the Soviet Union held on through 1941, and by the end of 1942 went on the offensive. Hitler achieved the opposite of what he intended. Instead of destroying the Soviet Union, he made it stronger by continuing to fight in 1945, long past any hope of a victory. He created a political vacuum in Europe. Germany lay in ruins. France, Britain, Italy, the Netherlands, and Belgium were incapable of dealing with the Soviet Union or with national liberation movements in their colonies. Hitler's campaign and its utter failure changed the role of the United States. In the New World Hitler's destructive efforts had created, there were only two major powers, the United States and the Soviet Union. If the former retreated into isolationism, the latter would fill any political vacuum unchallenged. The United States clearly could not let this happen. Three consequences of Hitler's defeat are still with us in the early 21st century. The Russian Republic no longer plays the same kind of role in the world as its Soviet predecessor, but the Soviet Union continues to pay more attention to it than to any other country of similar power. In discussions concerning the expansion of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, the United States and its NATO allies constantly ask how far NATO can expand without provoking the Russian Republic. NATO doesn't defer to any other country, so why Russia? The European Union was originally in large part a result of memories of German aggression in World War II. While the economic aspect of the EU has always been important, the countries involved also wanted to interweave the destiny of Germany with their destinies, so that a Nazi Germany could never happen again. The idea of containing Germany has never completely disappeared, but the EU has taken on a robust life of its own. Finally, the United States is now the major world power. The results of World War II drew us into international affairs on a permanent basis. The end of the Cold War merely changed the context in which we exercise world power. The main question for the 21st century will be whether the United States will be able to use this truly unprecedented power wisely. The reverberations of Hitler's invasion of the Soviet Union will eventually die out, but in terms of historical cause and effect, 60 years is not a long time. After all, the civil rights movement of the 1960s owed much to the unfinished business of the American Civil War. The repercussions of the Nazi invasion of the Soviet Union remain important, not so much because we fear another Hitler, but because we see more clearly the kind of world we live in when we understand how that world came to be.
You've been listening to Michael Richards, professor of history at Sweetbriar College in Virginia and the author of 20th Century Europe, A Brief History. This is Talking History. In our interview this week, we discussed the history of marriage. For our site of the week, we've chosen a site where you can learn more about one of the most popular marriage ceremonies, the Victorian wedding. Here to tell you about that site is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
Crowds of daylilies greet guests as they walk up the path, festooned with flowers and ribbons. The guests enjoy the Civil War-era nuptials, which take place at the Surratt House in southern Maryland. Built in 1852 as a middle-class plantation home, the historic Surratt House once served as a tavern and hostelry, a post office, and polling place during the decade before the Civil War. It was initially the home of Mary Surratt, the first woman to be executed by the United States government after she was found guilty of conspiring with John Wilkes Booth to assassinate Abraham Lincoln. Today, the museum presents a variety of programs and events specializing in recapturing history of mid-19th century life, including Victorian weddings. And if you can't visit the museum in person, check out the wonderful photos and history on their website at surratt.org.
Finally, turning to our list of coming attractions, during the week of October 1st, the History Channel will air a series on the history of organized crime, Organized Crime, A World History. The series begins on Monday, October 1st, with a look at organized crime in 19th and 20th century Sicily and the Sicilian Mafia with its rigid codes of secrecy and ability to infiltrate all aspects of society. That segment will be followed the same night by an examination of organized crime in Russia after the fall of communism and the rapacious new gangster class that arose in all of the former Soviet republics. On Tuesday, October 2nd, watch for a history of organized crime in Colombia and its drug war that has changed one of South America's most beautiful countries into one of its most dangerous. On Wednesday, the History Channel will look at organized crime in China, from the gang leaders of the 1920s in Shanghai to those of New York's Chinatown in the 1970s. And on Thursday, October 4th, the series concludes with a look at crime in India. Tune in and find out how Bombay, the home of the world's most prolific film industry, also became India's crime capital. Be sure to check your local listings for exact showtimes. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed the show. We invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History, Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Talking History is a production of Creighton University in the Organization of American Historians. And until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.
Going fast, coming soon, we made love in the afternoon. Found a flat, after that, we got married.